This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Robert Fisk with Amy Goodman. Recorded in Santa Fe, September 21st, 2005. Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for the English newspaper The Independent, had last-minute visa difficulties on his way to Santa Fe from Toronto, Canada for this long-planned Lannan event. So, from Toronto, live via satellite, he read from his latest book, The Great War for Civilization, before joining in conversation with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!
Thank you. Welcome to Lannan Foundation's seventh year of the Readings and Conversations series. I want to tell you that this is the most exciting first night of the series because we have a guest who's live and not with us tonight, someone who traveled a long distance and is going to be with us in Toronto. We're very lucky to have Robert Fisk with us. He is a man who answers his cell phone in the middle of demonstrations in Syria with 500,000 people. He is a tireless, indefatigable activist on behalf of the Middle East, having a voice of freedom, as is his wonderful interviewer tonight, our sister who speaks truth to power, Amy Goodman. Welcome her with me, please.
To be back in Santa Fe. As Jean said, there is good news and bad news. The bad news is that our guest tonight, Robert Fisk, the great journalist, the great chronicler of wars over the last decades, cannot be with us here in person. That's the bad news, but the good news is he is live with us just through a transcontinental satellite. There is appropriate technology. And I want to thank my colleagues, Dennis Moynihan and Sharif Abdelkaddous, absolutely relentless, tireless, who together with the Lannan Foundation have made this transcontinental conversation possible. I won't say that Robert Fisk wasn't able to come here because he couldn't land at Las Cruces Airport, although I understand as we were flying in that the airport is closed because President Bush flew in on Air Force One with some cargo planes when the local government asked him not to, saying the airport could not would not be able to bear the weight. And as a result of that campaign landing, they did $2.1 million in damage and have yet to pay back to repair the airport. But we are thrilled that Robert Fisk is with us anyway and will be beamed in to all of you here at the LENSIC. And what an honor it is, and just a shout out to our friends at KSFR and KUNM and KNME and all the public broadcasters that work to bring out the reality, the voices of people here and around the globe that are not usually heard, something Robert Fisk is known for doing and has been doing for decades. A chronicler of history, eloquent, fearless, what he has brought to people around the globe is information, facts on the ground. As William Kunstler, the great lawyer, the great late lawyer, said, I tip my hat to no one I think of Robert in that same way. He simply brings us the truth as he sees it, unadulterated. Over the last 35 years, he's covered the conflict in Northern Ireland, Israeli invasions of Lebanon, the Iranian Revolution, the Iran-Iraq War, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Gulf War, wars in Algeria and the former Yugoslavia, and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Most recently, year after year, he has been in Iraq from the time of the sanctions to the invasion and the occupation. One of the great testaments to how popular his writing is and how important is before the invasion, The Independent, the newspaper he writes for, had it freely available on their website. But soon it had become so popular that they realized, there might be some money to be made here. And the outcry around the world when you needed a subscription to read Robert Fisk's works is a testament to his great work. Robert is fearless. Having been beaten almost to death in covering Afghanistan, he simply continued and even told the story of that beating in a way that it almost sounded like it wasn't a beating of his own body, telling it as someone who simply wanted to record the facts of who was involved and what it could mean. The Literary Review says, "One is left in awe at Fisk's industry, commitment, and courage in reporting the ugliest of the world's current conflicts. Wonder, too, that Fisk can still write with sanity after witnessing such inhumanity." The Sunday Times says he is a devastating witness to the failure of politics to guard mankind against itself. And Robert Fisk, in the introduction to the book that will be coming out in under a month, The Great War for Civilization, from which he will be reading tonight, he says in his introduction, he talks about the role of the journalist. And he talks about someone who was recently here in Santa Fe, thanks to the Lannan Foundation, the great Israeli reporter Amira Haas. Robert Fisk writes, "I suppose in the end we journalists try or should try to be the first impartial witnesses to history. If we have any reason for our existence, the least must be our ability to report history as it happens so that no one can say, we didn't know, no one told us." Amira Haas, the brilliant Israeli journalist on Haaretz newspaper's reports on the occupied Palestinian territories, have outshone anything written by non-Israeli reporters, discussed with me, Robert Fisk writes, more than 2 years ago. He said, "I was insisting we had a vocation to write the first pages of history, but she interrupted me. No, Robert, you're wrong," she said. "Our job is to monitor the centers of power," Amira Haas said. And Robert wrote, "And I think in the end, that is the best definition of journalism I have heard, to challenge authority, all authority, especially so when governments and politicians take us to war, when they have decided that they will kill and others will die." We bring you one of the greatest reporters of our time, Robert Fisk.
Hello, folks, and Amy, thank you very much. I'm going to begin my readings tonight from my new book, The Great War for Civilization, and I'm going to begin with the last time I met Osama bin Laden. It seems kind of appropriate to begin at the end, so to speak, because that's rather what my book does. I met him in Afghanistan at a mountain camp, originally built by the CIA, of course, and I'll just give you the text of our last meeting, and I'll leave you to make up your mind what the implications of it are. There was a sudden scratching of voices outside the tent, thin and urgent, like the soundtrack of an old movie. Then the flap snapped up, and bin Laden walked in, dressed in a turban and green robes. I stood up, half bent under the canvas, and we shook hands, both of us forced by the tarpaulin to bend down like this, like Ottoman pashas, looking up into the other's face. Again, he looked tired, and I'd noticed a slight limp when he walked into the tent. His beard was greyer, his face thinner than I remembered in our last meeting. Yet he was all smiles, almost jovial, placing the rifle which he'd carried into the tent on the mattress on his left. insisting on more tea for his guest. For several seconds, he looked at the ground. Then he looked at me with an even bigger smile, beneficent, and I thought at once, very disturbing. "Mr. Robert," he began, and he looked around at the other men in combat jackets and soft brown hats who had crowded into the tent, the men of Al-Qaeda. "Mr. Robert, one of our brothers had a dream. He dreamed that you came to us one day on a horse, that you had a beard, and that you were a spiritual person. You wore a robe like us. This means you are a true Muslim." This was terrifying. It was one of the most fearful moments of my life. I understood bin Laden's meaning a split second in front of each of his words. Dream, horse, beard, spiritual, robe, Muslims. The other men in the tent were all nodding and looking at me, some smiling, others silently staring at the Englishman who had appeared in the dream of the brother. I was appalled. It was both a trap and an invitation, and the most dangerous moment to be among the most dangerous men in the world. I could not reject the dream, lest I suggest bin Laden was lying. Yet I could not accept its meaning without myself lying, without suggesting what was clearly intended of me, that I should accept this dream as a prophecy and a divine instruction might be fulfilled. For this man and these men to trust me, a foreigner, to come to them without prejudice, for them to regard me as honest, that was one thing. But to imagine that I would join them in their struggle, that I would become one with them, was beyond any possibility. The coven was waiting for a reply. Was I imagining this? Could this not just be an elaborate rhetorical way of expressing traditional respect towards a visitor? Was this not merely the attempt of a Muslim, many Westerners in the Middle East have experienced this, to gain an adherent to the faith? Was bin Laden really trying, let us be frank, to recruit me? I feared he was. And I immediately understood what this might mean. A Westerner, a white man from England, a journalist on a respectable newspaper, not a British convert to Islam, or an Arab or Asian Briton, would be a catch indeed. He would go unsuspected. He could become a government official, join an army, even, as I would contemplate just over 4 years later, become an airline pilot. I had to get out of this quickly, and I was trying to find an intellectual escape tunnel, working so hard in digging it that my brain was on fire. "Sheikh Osama," I began, even before I decided on my next words. "Sheikh Osama, I am not a Muslim." There was silence in the tent. "I am a journalist." No one could dispute that. "And the job of a journalist is to tell the truth." One might dispute that, but I hope not. "And that is what I intend to do in my life, to tell the truth." Bin Laden was watching me, carefully. And he understood. I was declining the offer. In front of his men, it was now bin Laden's turn to withdraw, to cover his retreat gracefully. "If you tell the truth, that means you are a good Muslim," he said. The men in the tent, in their combat jackets and beards, all nodded at this sagacity. Bin Laden smiled. I was saved. As the old cliche goes, I breathed again. No deal. Bin Laden was businesslike. He warned the Americans of a renewed onslaught against their forces in Saudi Arabia. "We are still at the beginning of military action against them," he said, "but we have removed the psychological obstacle against fighting the Americans. This is the first time in 14 centuries that the two holy shrines are occupied by non-Islamic forces." This is 1997. He insisted that the Americans were in the Gulf for oil and embarked on a modern history of the region to prove this. "We think that our struggle against America will be much simpler than that against the Soviet Union," bin Laden said. "I'll tell you something for the first time. Some of our mujahideen who fought in Afghanistan participated in operations against the Americans in Somalia, and they were surprised at the collapse in American military morale. We regard America as a paper tiger." This was a strategic error of some scale. The American retreat from its state-building mission in Somalia under President Clinton was not going to be repeated if a Republican president came to power, especially if the United States was under attack. True, over the years, the same loss of will might creep back into American military policy. Iraq would see to that. But Washington, whatever bin Laden might think, was going to be a far more serious adversary than Moscow. Yet he persisted. And I shall always remember Osama bin Laden's last words to me that night on the Bear Mountain. "Mr. Robert," he said, "from the mountain upon which you are sitting, we broke the Russian army and destroyed the Soviet Union. And I pray to God," these are his words, "that he will permit us to turn the United States into a shadow of itself." I sat in silence, thinking about these words as bin Laden discussed my journey back to Jalalabad with his guards. He was concerned that the Taliban, despite their sincerity, might object to his dispatching a foreigner through their checkpoints after dark. And so I was invited to pass the night in bin Laden's mountain camp. I was permitted to take just 3 photographs of him, this time by the light of a Toyota, which was driven to the tent with its headlights shining through the canvas to illuminate bin Laden's face. He sat in front of me, expressionless, a stone figure, and in the pictures I developed in Beirut 3 days later, he was a purple and yellow ghost. He said goodbye without much ceremony, a brief handshake and a nod, and vanished from the tent, and I lay down on the mattress with my coat over me to keep me warm. The men with their guns slept there too, while others armed with rifles and rocket launchers patrolled the low ridges around the camp. In the years to come, I would, of course, wonder who they were. Was the Egyptian Mohammed Atta among those young men in the tent, or Abdulaziz Al-Amari, or any of the other 19 men whose names we would all come to know just 4 years later? I cannot remember their faces now, cowled as they were, many of them in their scarves. Exhaustion and cold kept me awake. A shadow of itself was the expression that kept repeating itself to me. What did bin Laden and these dedicated, ruthless men have in store for us? I recall the next few hours like a freeze-frame film, waking so cold with ice in my hair, slithering back down the mountain trail in the Toyota with one of the Algerian gunmen in the back telling me that if we were in Algeria, he would cut my throat, that he was under bin Laden's orders to protect me and thus would give his life for me. The 3 men in the back and my driver stopped the jeep on the broken-up Kabul Jalalabad highway to say their dawn Fajr prayers. Beside the broad estuary of the Kabul River, they spread their maps and knelt as the sun rose over the mountains. Far to the northeast, I could see the heights of the Hindu Kush glimmering a pale white under an equally pale blue sky, touching the border of China that nuzzled into the wreckage of a land that was to endure yet more suffering in the coming years. Hills and rocks and water and ancient trees and old mountains. This was the world before the age of man. But most of all, I remember the first minutes after our departure from bin Laden's camp. It was still dark when I caught sight of a great light in the mountains to the north. For a while, I thought it was the headlights of another vehicle, another security signal from the camp guards to our departing Toyota. But it hung there for many minutes, and I began to realize that it was burning above the mountains and carried a faintly incandescent trail. The men in the vehicle were watching it too. "It is Halley's Comet," one of them said. He was wrong. It was a newly discovered comet, noticed for the first time only 2 years earlier by Americans Alan Hale and Tom Bopp. But I could see how Hale Bopp had become Halley to these Arab men in the mountains of Afghanistan. It was soaring above us now, trailing a golden tail, a sublime power moving at 70,000 kilometers an hour through the heavens. So we stopped the Toyota and climbed out to watch the fireball as it blazed through the darkness above us, the Al-Qaeda men and the Englishmen, all filled with awe at this spectacular, wondrous apparition of cosmic energy unseen for more than 4,000 years. "Mr. Robert, do you know what they say when a comet like this is seen?" It was the Algerian standing next to me. Now, both of us craning our necks upwards towards the sky. "It means," he said, "that there is going to be a great war." And so we watched the fire blaze through the pageant of stars and illuminate the firmament above us. I'm going to take you back now to 1981, to the old days, not of religious passion, but of old Arab nationalism. My first interview with Yasser Arafat in a darkened apartment block in Civil War Beirut. Arafat, this is from my previous book, Pity the Nation. Arafat had a face that was both charming and yet somehow scandalous. He had large expressive eyes and a rough moustache. There was a slight, the very faintest trace of Jean-Paul Belmondo, but the 3-day growth of beard was disturbing. It spoke of laxity and failure, like a man who'd spent the night underneath Waterloo Bridge with a gin bottle or sleeping on a subway grill on the Lower East Side. Arafat didn't drink, and the stubble was to hide a persistent rash, but the impression was difficult to shake off. There was no youth or flamboyance. No teenager would ever pin this man's picture on a wall next to Che Guevara. There was no inspiration in the face, no power. It was easy to understand why his enemies mocked him. Revolution gone to seed. He was middle-aged, watchful, and his eyes seemed to grow larger and more agitated the longer you looked at him. They danced across Labadie's countenance and the faces of other men in the room for any hint of concern, while his mouth puckered in a friendly, almost feminine way. The eyes never stopped moving or questioning your presence. What I wanted to say was, "Mr. Arafat, what big eyes you've got." But of course, what I actually said was, "Good evening, Mr. Arafat. It was very kind of you to see me," for this was a formal business, a journalist visiting an Arab leader. He was smiling, formally polite, and insisted upon speaking English, a language upon which he was to work hard and successfully in the years to come. At the time, in 1981, he spoke with just enough difficulty to make a visitor feel sorry for him. Labadi shrewdly realized that this could be an attractive, useful asset, and thus sometimes allowed Arafat to talk away in barely comprehensible English to no apparent purpose. Arafat embarked on an inconsequential tour d'horizon. He was concerned about the situation in Afghanistan, prepared to be a mediator if this would help to bring about a ceasefire between the Soviets and the guerrillas. He was astonished that Reagan recently condemned the PLO as terrorists. The PLO representative at the UN had been instructed to protest about this to the UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim. It was at around this moment that Arafat's mood began to undergo startling changes. One moment he would be outlining with great care and in a quiet voice his relationship with King Hussein. The next, almost choking with anger, shouting his condemnation of the terrorist military junta that governed Israel. He gave the impression of a man caught between emotion and rhetoric, one who, had he observed his audience carefully enough, might have been able to decide which of the two would have the more productive effect. The problem was that his anger was real. "In other wars," I said, "the various armies of guerrillas, insurgents, rebels, call them what you will, seem to be able to confine most of their attacks, not always but usually, to military and industrial targets. But Palestinians often appear to end up killing Israeli children and women." The fist slammed onto the table. "Babies, only babies. Yes, only babies and children. Do you believe them, the Israelis? Another big lie. What is going on in the south of Lebanon?" The fist slammed down mightily again. "Who are suffering from the Phantom and from F-15 and F-16 aircraft and from cluster bombs and the fragmentation shells, even forbidden weapons? But the Israelis have the right to use very up-to-date and sophisticated weapons, and I have not the right to use my armies to defend my people and to defend my small children." Arafat started muttering about rumours. He wanted to say lies, but the word kept coming out as rumours. "Would he not agree that Israeli civilians were killed?" I asked. "Rumours! But children had been killed in a recent Palestinian attack. Another big rumour!" Arafat was shouting. Labadi began to lean forward across the table in case his carefully arranged interview got out of hand. "Did the Palestinians not have difficulty in justifying certain attacks?" I said. "Always they, the Israelis, are preparing communiques about small children and old women. But such attacks did happen, did they not?" "It doesn't, they don't, definite!" Arafat's eyes were running round the room, to Labadi, to three advisers who were sitting to his right in business suits and who had listened coldly and unmoved to this exchange. The eyes swung back to me. "Why do you ask these questions?" Arafat was reaching out, I realised at once, for the reason, for some clue as to why things were going wrong. The plot. Someone must have told me to ask these questions. He did not say this, but I knew that was what he was thinking. "Definitely I have the right to resist. Let them withdraw from my homeland, from our homeland." I was recording the conversation, and on the tape, Arafat's voice now grew so loud that it was impossible to control the sound level. His shouting made the needle in my recorder jump frighteningly, flicking again and again into the area of the dial marked red for warning. Then Arafat's knee began to bounce up and down, shaking the table. 18 months later, Pierre Jamal's foot would tap in agitation in a similar way in his high-ceilinged office. Perhaps there was some kind of dangerous signal in Lebanon which I was missing, some message which was the political equivalent of the Palestinian gunman putting a bullet in the breech of the Kalashnikov, clack, click, on the road to Tyre. Arafat was waiting to see if I would continue. "Well, there might be some people," I began again, "who would agree with Arafat's criticisms, yet when women and babies were killed, I am against it." Silence. "But you have to ask these citizens why they are living in my homeland. Such incidents were a mistake." "A mistake." "They were a mistake." "Yes." He was not shouting so much now. His voice was almost inaudible. "Yes, I am against it. But you have to ask these citizens why they are living in my homeland. They are participating in this tragedy." The voice was rising again. "They are participating in this crime with their government, the Israeli military junta. They have to stop it." Arafat's English began to collapse under the immense weight of his fury, the verbs and tenses snapping and breaking apart from under the strain. He was literally out of breath. Asking about a future Palestinian state was like applying cloves to an aching tooth. Arafat's fury was transformed almost at once into sentiment, into a long, cloying resume of his personal dreams. Palestine would be a democratic oasis in the Middle East. It would be a liberal democracy. Democracy, the word, if not the political system, seemed to obsess him. We are proud of our democracy in the revolution. It is the hardest and most difficult kind of democracy, because it is democracy among the guns. But we have succeeded in creating a democracy, and our freedom fighters who have been given a democracy will continue to have democracy in their independent state. Democracy, democracy, democracy. The word seemed to have the same effect on Arafat as terrorism had for the Israelis. If you went on saying it often enough, anything could be justified. Better still, you might end up believing in it. My next section is also from my previous book, Pity the Nation, and it has a very powerful resonance with modern-day Iraq. I won't insult you and be patronizing as a Brit by telling you what that resonance is. I think you'll spot it. It's my account of the bombing of the US Marine base on the 23rd of October, 1983, in Beirut. The first distant, soft tremor wakes me up. It is a bright morning, and the sea outside my balcony is splashing in a friendly way against the promenade. Bomb explosions, shell bursts, a heartbeat in Beirut now. I decide to sleep in. It is Sunday morning. A few seconds later, another gentle quake, a very slight, intimate change in the air pressure in the house. A second bomb. I lie in bed for another 4 minutes. The phone rings. It's my landlord, who lives on the ground floor. His voice is breaking with urgency. Mr. Robert, Mr. Robert, it's me. Get up, get up. They have bombed the Marines. Mr. Terry and Foley are leaving. They cannot have bombed the Marines. Where? In the street. Anderson is running for his car, Foley beside him. His camera is dangling from his shoulder. Terry, wait for me. Anderson would have gone without me. He drives fast, viciously down the corniche. Foley's face is fixed on the road, and he talks without looking at me. They got the Marines and they got the French. Car bombs. That's all the radios are saying. How? Foley's angry. How the hell do I know? It may be a load of crap, but I heard the explosions. The French battalion headquarters is in a 9-story building called the Drakkar beyond Rauché, before the airport. When Anderson turns off the road, Foley says, holy fuck, and we're out of the car amid hundreds of French paratroopers and Lebanese soldiers. There has been an earthquake. The entire headquarters of the French 1st Chasseur Parachutiste Regiment, all 9 floors of it, has disappeared. I run up to a smoking crater, 20 feet deep and 40 wide. Piled beside it like an obscene sandwich are the 9 floors of the building. There are legs and arms lying in the muck, a French officer's chest, medal still pinned to the battle dress, but no head. A man pulled from the concrete with his intestines spilling out. How many do you think can survive this? A soldier asked me. Combien, combien, how many? He puts out a hand in a sad, kindly way, wanting to show a sort of respect for something that lay on the ground between us. Please be careful where you walk. Lieutenant-Colonel Philippe de Longo gazes fearfully into the burning crater, staring at the catastrophe that has struck his men. He talks slowly in a dreamy kind of way to me, in shock. We found 3 people who are alive. There are about 100 soldiers still under there. The bomb lifted up the building. Right up, vous comprenez, comprenez? You understand? And put it down again, over there. He points vaguely to the wreckage. The bomb lifted the 9-story building into the air and moved it 20 feet. The whole building became airborne. The crater is where the building was. How could this be done? It was a car bomb, he says. A suicide driver. From a jagged cavern in the crunched cement, a hand emerges, a small chain bracelet round its wrist. A French soldier crawls to the hole and holds the hand in his own. The hand clasps him, grips him, seizes his arm, and clings to him until its owner dies. Fisk, we're going! Anderson is dragging my arm. I've got to get to the Marines. The airport road is deserted, but there's a cloud of white smoke streaming upwards from the far end where the Marines are based. We'll find Bob Jordan. You try to find him in the press room. I'll look for him in the BLT, the Battalion Landing Team headquarters of the Marines. Jordan is the Marine press officer. But when Anderson stops the car, he's frowning. Marines are shouting and screaming from behind their barbed wire fencing, and there are heavy explosions. But it's not this which is troubling Anderson. Where's the BLT? At the other end of the fence. Terry. It's gone. It's behind the smoke. It isn't. It's fucking disappeared. Anderson throws himself at the fencing. AP, AP, I've got to come in. You've got to let me in. There's a young Marine guard there, perhaps only 18, and he pulls the wire aside for Anderson and myself. We run forward across rubble and tree branches and through smoke, and there in front of us are heaps of bodies, some in Marine uniform, others in front of us simply bone-crushed, broken-backed, arms and legs twisted into impossible positions. Who did this? Anderson shouts at the young Marines. There are 3 of them now. They look stupidly at Anderson. Only the youngest talks. Guy with a bomb came in a truck, went up with a bomb. Behind a wrecked jeep, I come across the bodies of 10 more Marines, lined up on the ground as if on parade, their faces covered by tarpaulin, their bare feet black with dust, poking incongruously from the bottom. One of the sheets has fallen away, and the body beneath is quite naked, but still covered in thick dust. His mouth is open, and I wonder if he's alive and trying to talk, but I see that the top of his head is missing. Down a narrow path to our left, Major Robert Jordan appears. Never a humorous man, he looks stunned. There's blood smeared down his arm, on his uniform, on his face. "I've been pulling guys out," he said. There are more explosions from the heaps of masonry in front of us. A young Marine is being led away from it, a black soldier whose head lolls from side to side like a doll. Jordan has no explanation for what has happened, no careful military excuses. Someone drove a truck with explosives into the compound. He crashed through the south gate and into the lobby of the building. He detonated the explosives inside, collapsing all the walls down themselves. By the roots of a tree, I find a copy of the 24th Marine Amphibious Unit magazine, Root Scoop. It is dated 15th September 1983, just 5 weeks ago. On page 2, First Lieutenant Miles Burdeen has written an article entitled "People Depend on Marines." He complains that the mosquitoes are driving him insane, that he's exhausted from standing on duty, drenched in sweat and wanting to talk to a girl. But, I quote, "To the people who merit pity, go into Hooterville and look at what the people live on, the food they eat and the clothes they wear. Look at the faces of the children and realize the death, destruction and poverty many have experienced. We will depart this country in a short time for the benefits of home, but the Lebanese people are home right now. They're depending on us to help restore peace, so they can rebuild their economy, their city, their homes, and their lives. As a result of our efforts, Beirut someday will possibly be a comfortable home for its people, just as America is now." The papers blow across the ruins. A Marine aboard an amphibious vehicle by the trees has given up any pretense at soldiering. He sits behind his machine gun, shoulders heaving, his head in his hands. One of his American officers puts an arm around him. Then he turns to Anderson and myself and the camera crews who've come trailing into the Marine base. "You can film," he says, "but please don't take pictures of bodies. Remember, there are guys right now who'd like to shoot you. There's a lot of grief down there." Out through the hot sea mist, we can see a giant shape gliding along the horizon. It is the battleship New Jersey, creeping up the Mediterranean, having lost the battle before it ever fired its guns. Ladies and gentlemen, the penultimate reading I'm going to give you comes from my new book again, In the Aftermath of the 1991 Gulf War. At our request, the Shiite Muslims had risen up against Saddam in southern Iraq, and we then sat back and allowed them to be butchered by Saddam. Their families poured down the main highways towards Kuwait, desperate for help and safety. All the while, the tide of sick and starving and frightened people shuffled past us. Some came in hand-pushed carts, old men and babies with filthy blankets thrown over them. And I thought of the medieval carts that went from house to house when the Great Plague struck Europe, collecting the dead. Some of these people in these carts were dead. There were two television crews pointing their lenses at close range into the faces of the refugees. And I noticed how, for once, the faces did not react to the cameras. It was as if every face was also dead. Two U.S. embassy officials were standing beside a station wagon along with a senior American military officer. "We can't have them just all coming down here," one of the embassy men said to Staff Sergeant Nold of the 1st Armored Division. "They can't cross the border. We have no facilities to handle this. They've got to go back." "Look, you've got to stop them moving down this road," the embassy man was saying. "It's tragic. I know that. But we simply don't have the facilities for them." Cooney asked if extra first aid tents couldn't be erected for the refugees, and the embassy man sighed. It wasn't supposed to be like this. Liberation, a clean victory, and now this mess. And on television, you could see his problem. "You've got to stop them, Sergeant," the embassy man repeated. The officer joined in. "Iraqi agents could infiltrate back into Kuwait among the refugees." But suddenly, there on this cold, damp, hellish road, all the bright sunlight of what was best about America, all the hope and compassion and humanity that Americans like to believe they possess, suddenly shone among us. For the young, tired 1st Armored Division Staff Sergeant Nold turned angrily on the man from the U.S. Embassy. "I'm sorry, sir, but if you're going to give me an order to stop these people, I can't do that. They're coming here begging, old women crying, sick kids, boys begging for food. We've already given them most of our rations. But I have to tell you, sir, that if you give me an order to stop them, I just won't do that." You could see the embassy men wince. First it was these pesky folk cluttering up the highway, then the television cameras, and now a soldier who wouldn't obey orders. But Sergeant Nold just turned his back on the diplomat and walked over to a queue of refugee cars. "Tell these people to park at the side of the road over there," he yelled at the soldiers on his checkpoint. "Tell them to be patient, but we'll try to look after them. Don't send them back." Around Nold, two famished Iraqi families, the women in filthy black chadors, the children barefooted, the men's faces dazed, were sitting in the dirt, tearing open the American military ration packs with their nails, scoffing the cold lumps of stew, pouring the contents of the sauce packets into their mouths. Across the cold sand, Nold's soldiers had already helped to house an Iraqi woman and five children. Their story was simple and terrible. Their father had been executed for refusing to join the Iraqi Republican Guard, their mother raped afterwards. The children were taken by their aunt southwards towards the American lines, and there they all were now, squatting in an abandoned electricity shed. The Americans were feeding them and had found four puppy dogs and a small, gentle-faced donkey, which they'd given to the grimy children. Now a line of battered cars was driving steadily towards Nold's position, packed with fearful civilians. Many had not eaten for days. The men were unshaven, the women in tears, the children had urinated in the car in a long journey across a devastated Iraq. Whole families were crying for civilian relatives killed in the Allied air assault. Their convoy stank. A little girl was held out of the window of an old black Mercedes by a screaming woman. The child's body was jerking grotesquely, the convulsions about to kill her. This was not quite what the generals in Riyadh had been thinking about when they announced their days of battlefield preparation and communications interdiction. Nold ordered one of his men to run down the line of cars. "Where is the car with the sick child?" the soldier kept shouting in English until someone translated his question to Arabic. There was a wail from the Mercedes. "Get a medic down here, fast," the soldier ordered. Two more Americans arrived, a big black soldier who took the little girl into his arms and touched her brow. "Oh, Jesus, she's having a fit," he said. "Tell the field hospital we're coming down with her." The stricken child, together with her distraught mother, were taken from the car. Nold arrived to order the vehicle out of the column. "Tell the rest of the family we need to search their vehicle, then they can go and wait by the Red Cross truck." Nold and his 12 soldiers of the 1st Armored Division handed out more of their own rations. No medals for performing these duties, of course. And with good reason. For a conflict of interest was becoming apparent. That is why the American officer and the US diplomats had arrived to inspect Nold's position. The newly returned and legitimate government of Kuwait, on whose behalf the Americans had gone to war, had no desire to see these refugees given sanctuary in Kuwait. The officer even muttered into Nold's ear the following revealing sentence. "We had an Iraqi soldier give himself up near here the other day, and a Kuwaiti soldier just took him to one side, shot him in the head, and pushed his body into a ditch. If you let these people through Safwan, they could face the same danger." Nold looked at the officer in contempt. He must have known very well what was going on. He was being ordered to send these people back to their deaths and execution, not because of lack of facilities or Iraqi infiltration, but because the Kuwaiti royal family didn't want them cluttering up their newly liberated treasure house emirate, and Nold refused. There weren't many good moments in this war, or any other, but here just for a moment an angel's wings brushed past us. The spirit of Raoul Wallenberg in the Budapest rail yards handing out Swedish passports to the doomed Jews of Hungary. No, this wasn't the Second World War. Let's have done with such obscene parallels. But these Iraqis would die if they were forced to turn back, and the sergeant had disobeyed an order so that they might live. Would that Bush and Cheney and Schwarzkopf and John Major had shown his courage. The last reading I'm going to give to you, slightly longer, is, of course, from my new book, and it's September 11th, 2001. The chapter headline is Why. I'd forgotten to turn off my mobile phone. I felt its vibration in my pocket only seconds after I'd sat down on the transatlantic flight. And my first thought, though we'd not yet finished boarding, was that I'd broken the rules. We believe in laws instinctively, without question, secular rules that govern our lives rather than religious dictates. So I left my seat and returned to the air bridge on which passengers were still waiting to board the Airbus. "Robert?" It was the features editor. "Look, I think you should know that after all this, we're probably going to have to hold your Sabra and Shatila investigation piece again. A light aircraft has just flown into the World Trade Center in New York, and the building's on fire." "Damn, damn, damn! This was the third time. Does it really matter that much?" I asked. "A light aircraft? Well, it seems quite serious, and I think it would look rather odd having a big story like this in New York and us carrying a 19-year-old story on the front of the features section." I gave up. It was as if our new investigation of the Israeli role in the Beirut Palestinian massacres of 1982 would never be published. All through the first week of September 2001, I'd been pushing for space. Then on Thursday, 6 September, Simon Kellner, my editor, decided it could run on Monday, 10 September. Then Kellner went on holiday, and Ian Birrell, the deputy editor, took over Simon's seat and postponed my report until the morning of the 12th. That meant the final proofs would go away on the afternoon of the 11th of September. In the months to come, I would reflect on the personal irony of those last minutes at Brussels Airport. I was reading through the minutiae of a crime against humanity which had been committed almost exactly 19 years earlier. While on the other side of the Atlantic, at that very moment, an international crime against humanity was on the point of being committed. At Sabra and Shatila, and in the mass murders afterwards, we estimated that at least 1,700 Palestinian men, women, and children were slaughtered. In New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, more than twice that number of human lives were about to be extinguished. After the call from the features editor, I returned to my seat on the Airbus. Then my phone rang again. Anne Penketh was calling from my foreign desk. "It seems a helicopter has hit the Pentagon, Robert. Don't know any more yet, but I think we need you to write today." I was sitting in business class, and there was an airline satellite phone tapped into the armrest beside me. I ran my credit card through the side swipe, and the screen showed positive. I'd be able to go on talking to London and to send my copy in flight. The last passengers were boarding, and I walked across to the chief purser. I told him about the helicopter. I kept referring to the Free Trade Building rather than the World Trade Center, although I had a vivid image of the Twin Towers in my mind, sentinels above Manhattan to the left of my taxi when I returned to JFK after giving a lecture at Princeton a few months before. I made one more call to the office on my mobile. "Robert," Anne had just enough time to say before I was forced to close down. "It was an airliner, a passenger airliner that flew into the World Trade Center. And now there's another." I closed down the phone. The horror of this was obvious, but my journalist brain, the computer that calculates event, reaction, deadline, was moving. What was happening in the United States was deliberate. It was, in the most classic of clichés, a terrorist attack. The American East Coast was 6 hours behind Brussels. Thousands would be arriving in the Twin Towers for work and in the Pentagon. We were over the Irish Sea when I made my first satellite call to London. Leonard Doyle, my foreign editor, took the call. He sounded over-serious, his Father Doyle voice, as I always called it, but I realized he was just shocked. "Robert, two planes into the World Trade Center, airliner into the Pentagon, another airliner crashed in Pennsylvania. You should see the pictures." On board the Airbus, they brought round the pre-lunch drinks. The gin and tonic tasted like tonic. 20,000, 30,000 dead? That's how we thought then. This was on a still unimaginable scale. And what would be America's revenge? I recalled the old newsreels after Pearl Harbor, the day of infamy, when the soundtracks filled with racist demands to crush the sneaky Japs. Bin Laden. I kept coming back to Bin Laden. This day represented not just a terrible crime, but a terrible failure. The collapse of decades of maimed, hopeless, selfish policies in the Middle East, which we would at last recognize, if we were wise, or which, more likely, we would now bury beneath the rubble of New York. An undiscussable subject whose mere mention would indicate support for America's enemies. I walked to the aircraft galley and asked the cabin crew what they thought. All four planes must have been hijacked. There must have been many hijackers. "They wanted to die," the young stewardess said without thinking. And we all agreed, and then the purser looked at me very hard. I knew what he was thinking. We too were bound for America. Those four planes had taken off like ours, heading off into the bright morning with friendly crews and law-abiding passengers. I walked round the plane with the purser. I didn't like it. I guess I came back with the images of 13 passengers in my mind, 13 I didn't like, because they had beards or stared at me in what I could easily translate as hostility, or because they were fiddling with worry beads or reading Qurans. Of course, they were all Muslims. In just a few minutes, the so-called liberal Fisk, who had worked in the Middle East for a quarter of a century, who had lived among Arab Muslims for almost half his life, whose own life had been saved by Muslims on countless occasions in Lebanon, Iraq, and Iran. Yes, that nice, friendly Robert Fisk had turned into a racist, profiling the innocent on board his aircraft because they had beards or brown eyes or dark skin. I felt dirty. But this, I already suspected, was one of the purposes of this day, to make us feel dirty, to make us so fearful or so angry that we no longer behaved rationally. The Belgian Airbus captain was on the public address system. "Terrorist attacks on New York, Washington. United States closes its airspace to all commercial aircraft." We were dumping fuel over the sea far to the west of Ireland before returning to Europe. We started to fly in big concentric circles, sunlight bursting through the starboard, then through the port windows of the plane, as if the sun was perpetually rising and setting, the desolation of the North Atlantic mocking our warm isolation. They served lunch as we described these spheres in the sky, foie gras and steak with glasses of Medoc. I looked at my notebook. I wrote down the names Balfour, Lawrence of Arabia, Bin Laden. The moment my Airbus touched down in Brussels, my mobile began to ring like a grasshopper. The office, radio stations in America, Britain, Ireland, France. I was in the taxi to my hotel when Carsten Zweig came on the line. Robert, have you seen the pictures? No, I said. You must see the pictures. They are incredible. Carsten, I said, I'm still in the taxi. I can't watch television in a bloody taxi. Look at the pictures, he said again. You've got to see the pictures. The moment you reach your hotel room, look at the pictures, then you'll understand. When I reached my room, I turned on the television. And of course, the Twin Towers were smoking, incandescent. Figures floated like feathers, fast, upside down, with a terrible grace. The United passenger jet slid into the side of the South Tower again and again, as if some scientific achievement was being demonstrated, as if this airliner was supposed to knife so effortlessly into the thin skin of the tower. Hollywood could not compete with this, because it was Hollywood. The disaster movie of September 11th would never be made. It had already been made. Al-Qaeda Productions got there first. This was shock and awe before America invented the expression for its invasion of Iraq. I sat on my hotel bed, flicking channels, watching the towers burn and their biblical descent in dust and ash. Our New York correspondent, David Usborne, had been called by the office with the story of the light aircraft hitting one of the towers and took the subway downtown only to find the South Tower falling at his feet. Again and again, the towers fell. Then the planes. Only ash and smoke were taped at the Pentagon and in that pit in the Pennsylvania field. But New York remained the iconic image that would now justify the war on terror. September 11th, I suspected, was to become a law, a piece of legislation that would be used to close down any conversation, lock up any suspect, invade any country. Opposition? Just show those bodies hurtling once more towards the streets of Manhattan. I lay on my hotel pillow, watching them again on the television, at the foot of my bed. They moved at such speed, they had a kind of symmetry to them, until you realize that their legs were kicking. That this was the moment of awfulness, the moment I tried to understand when I looked into those monstrous carbonized faces of the dead at Mutler Ridge in the first Gulf War. Those figures cascaded out of the sky and they fell over and over at the bottom of my bed, plummeting into the blankets. And then I realized what Carsten had meant when he urged me to concentrate on the pictures. The message was the act. Even if the casualties had not been so appalling, the wickedness so awesome, the attacks themselves so professional, this was not a routine act of terror. There would be no claims of responsibility. I was sure of that. There would be no statements from Bin Laden or Al-Qaeda. No explanations. The message, the statement, was the act itself. The claim was contained in the pictures. Our own television cameras were the claim of responsibility. I remembered again what Bin Laden had said to me about his wishes for America. And looking at those pictures of the thunderous, concrete, thick clouds that surrounded Manhattan, I had to admit that night that New York was now a shadow of itself. Ladies and gentlemen, Amy, that's the end of my readings. It's up to you, Amy, if you want any chat to me now. Tired though I feel. In fact, I have no sound from Santa Fe except... Ah!
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great.
And I can hear that too. Thank you very much.
Well, Robert, that's almost 1,000 people clapping as you are there in Toronto. And I just want to thank the Lensic Theatre for really facilitating something that, well, they certainly have never done here before. We found out at about 7 o'clock last night that Robert would not be able to make it to Santa Fe. Within hours, the pieces of this production were in place. Many people have worked tirelessly to make this happen through the night. Among them, I want to thank Bob Martin and the staff at the Lensic Performing Arts Center. The people of TV To Go in Toronto, where Robert is right now, the people of Satellite West, who provided the satellite truck outside, drove from dawn this morning from Phoenix to make this possible. John Evans and Christy and Lori and all the folks at Lannan Foundation who were willing to go this route. Again, to Dennis Moynihan and to Sharif Abdelkaddous, and to all of you for coming. This is, I think, very important, the idea that we can link up with people around the world discussing these absolutely critical issues. Physical distance is not what matters.
Hi. I was just, your mic was off. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Okay. Disregard that man behind the curtain. Well, Robert, I wanted to read you a headline, Democracy Now!, just a few days ago that our producer Mike Burke put together. New questions about Iraq's sovereignty are being raised after British forces attacked an Iraqi jail Monday because they believed two detained British commandos were inside. British troops opened fire on the jail in Basra and used 6 armored vehicles to smash down the jail's walls as helicopter gunships flew overhead. The provincial governor of Basra described the British assault as barbaric, savage, and irresponsible. The Associated Press reported 150 prisoners escaped during the siege. As the British raided the prison, Iraqis started attacking the British vehicles with firebombs and rockets. One of the British armored fighting vehicles was set ablaze. Photos showed a British soldier on fire, climbing out of the hatch and jumping to the ground as a crowd pelted him. An Iraqi official said the British soldiers were arrested after they'd fired an Iraqi police officer. At the time, the British soldiers were undercover and dressed as Iraqis. After the prison was breached in Basra, the two soldiers were found not to be in the jail, but in a nearby house. The British Army attempted to downplay the incident, claiming the men were released after negotiations. The government said it feared for the lives of the British commandos after discovering they'd been handed to, quote, militia elements. The British attack on the Iraqi jail came one day after British forces arrested 3 members of the Shiite Mahdi Army. And then just the day after this week, British Defense Secretary John Reid saying the Army had been absolutely right to break into the jail. And this just today from Reuters, Iraqi police staged an angry anti-British protest in Basra as London and Baghdad sought to quell tension over the British raid. About 200 policemen who work at the police station and jail damaged during Monday's British raid marched through the streets calling for the city's police chief to be fired and for the, quote, British terrorists to be returned to Iraqi jurisdiction. Can you make sense of this for us?
Well, I'm in Toronto, not Basra, Amy. Look, there are various extra questions which it raises. One is, what were British special forces in plain clothes and in disguise doing in Basra? What role are they supposed to have in peacekeeping in southern Iraq? We know and have known for some time that the police force in Basra has been largely infiltrated by Iraqi Shiite militiamen. That's true. Journalists who've inquired into it, including an American correspondent, have been murdered. The British have allowed Basra to slowly slide under the auspices of these militiamen, some of them from Muqtada Sadr, others from different Shiite groups. For example, there were at least last year 42 murders of former Ba'athists, including several women, in Basra, and the British Army did nothing about it. They thought that it was better to leave the murders untouched rather than try and find the murderers, who might, of course, have included policemen. It is believed that police were also responsible for the murder of the American journalist, who also was working with the New York Times. We've been aware for a long time that the British have been turning a blind eye. When Christian alcohol sellers were murdered, they did nothing. And yet they continue to say, well, we know how to police an area of Iraq because we had all this wonderful experience in Northern Ireland. Not that great, actually. I didn't quite follow it, but that's what they said. And we allowed the story to go out, the narrative to be told that the British got on better with the locals than the Americans did in the north, because they weren't so heavy-handed. What it is now quite clear has happened is that the British allowed Basra to fall under the sway of militias who effectively took over the police and ended up having to threaten or fight the people they were supposed to be working with, even using the Special Air Service, the so-called elite SAS. I can't make much more sense of it than the moment. Next time I go to Iraq, I'll be going to Basra to try and find out. But from Toronto, I can't do better than I'm telling you now.
Your assessment of the situation in Iraq, I think you were the first journalist to be talking about quagmire very early on, but that was now, well, almost several years ago. What do you think is an accurate picture of what's happening now and what needs to be done?
This is a PhD thesis. Three days after the Americans came to Baghdad, I said the real story is about to begin, and that is the story of the war against American occupation. And a lot of my colleagues thought that was a very, very funny. They hooted at me with laughter over it, though not anymore. Look, apart from the Kurdistan area, Iraq is now in a state of total anarchy and chaos. No roads are safe outside Baghdad. Much of Baghdad is in insurgent hands. Only the little green zones, the armored hotel areas, where the Westerners live and swim and in some cases don't even leave their rooms, and that, alas, applies to many journalists. Only here are people allowed to have the illusion that things are getting better, things are improving. Outside in the streets, where some journalists still go, including, for example, my colleague Patrick Coben of The Independent and myself and The Guardian newspaper, not most Americans, though one or two, out in the streets where few of us go, it is hell on earth. I managed to get a couple of weeks ago to the mortuary in the city of Baghdad, as I've often gone in the past, counting the bodies at midday and midsummer out in the heat. There were 26 by midday. 9 had arrived by 9 in the morning. And I managed to get the official figures for July for the total number of violent deaths in Baghdad alone. And the figure was 1,100 violent deaths, men, women and children, shot, butchered, knifed, executed, death squad killings, a figure which, of course, is not given out by the Iraqi Health Ministry and is certainly not given out by the occupation authorities. We now have a situation in Iraq where there is a full-scale insurgency by both Shiites and Sunnis against Western forces. Once an insurgency of that kind starts in a Muslim country, it is impossible to quench it. Sorry, you guys, can we put the book back? Let's start again. We got it wrong at one point. You can't do that. I was discussing with an Iraqi friend 3 weeks ago in Baghdad what he thought the answer was. And he said, there is no answer. You've got to go. And I wrote at the time that I thought there was a terrible equation in Iraq. And it goes like this. The Americans must leave. And the Americans will leave, but the Americans can't leave. And that's the equation that turns sand into blood. Once you become an occupying power, you take upon responsibilities for the civilians, which we have not done, but you also have responsibility to yourself. You have to keep justifying over and over and over again to your own populations. You were right to do it. Okay, there were no weapons of mass destruction, but we got rid of Saddam. Okay, we haven't got the electricity working yet, but there is a constitution. Well, we hope there'll be a constitution, and we did have some elections, didn't we? Do you remember them in January? And all the time, the people die in ever greater numbers. Remember that figure for July, 1,100. That's just Baghdad. What does that mean for the whole country? 5,000 dead in July? What does that mean in the whole of Iraq in a year? 5/12 are? You see the problem. We're talking of 50,000, 60,000 dead a year now. And the worst figure we've heard is 100,000 since 2003. And yet still we don't get statistics. When individual journalists have to go to hospital mortuaries and count the bloated corpses on the floor, you know you've got problems. And I tell you, I the last time I was in Baghdad, I began to ask myself whether the dangers, and I've never done this on any other war except for the Algerian war, which was very similar in many ways, questioning whether the dangers of covering Iraq are any longer worth the story. I suppose I think they are, but I guess, having looked at my face in the mirror occasionally and seen the grey hairs, I wonder if I should keep going there. I probably will, but I'm not sure.
Robert, what about the number of journalists who have died. This weekend, there's going to be a major anti-war protest in Washington on the 24th and all over the country. Two of the people who will be there are the mother and brother of Jose Coso, who is the Spanish cameraman for Telecinco, killed at the Palestine Hotel the day before the U.S. forces pulled down the statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdaus Square.
No, it was the same day. It was the first Armored Division tank on the Jumeirah Bridge. It was an American tank that killed him. Mm. Absolutely, but it was the same day. Mm.
Now, he is one of scores of people, of journalists, who have died. Most recently, a Reuters photographer killed, his colleague arrested by U.S. forces and held. Another is being held at the Abu Ghraib prison. Dozens of journalists. What about your colleagues in Iraq right now?
The total figure of journalists to have died during and after the 2003 invasion up to date is now 68, the most recent being an Iraqi stringer, again for the New York Times, in Basra, who was found dumped on a waste tip, executed with three bullets through the back of his head. I suspect the Iraqi police, quote unquote, killed him, like I suspect the Iraqi police killed the American journalist in Basra. Look, there's no doubt it's becoming the most dangerous story for journalists anywhere ever. If you want to look at the worst period, it would be in Bosnia in 92, when a lot of journalists who'd never been in wars before were sent in to Bosnia and were dying at the rate of dozens a month. And that was primarily, I think, because he was sending very young men whose experience of war was Hollywood, where the hero, of course, always survives. And what is shocking about this is that almost all the journalists who are being killed, almost without exception in Iraq, are experienced, in many cases middle-aged, guys who've been under fire many times before, who know about the lethality of weapons, and whose jobs and lives are simply no longer respected. I've never been in a war like the Iraq War, in which our lives are so endangered, so targeted by all sides, it sometimes seems. And I'm not sure what we can do about it. The American correspondents, some of them, are guarded by armed Iraqis. The New York Times has a compound with four watchtowers and armed Iraqis with NYT, New York Times, on their black T-shirts. NBC lives in a hotel in the Karada district with iron grills. The AP lives in the Palestine Hotel with two armored walls. Very rarely do they ever venture out, and never do the American staffers go on the streets. As I say, we still go out with Iraqi friends. We actually go out to lunch in restaurants in Iraq. But I think that's probably because as long as we're with Iraqis and we look at our watch and say, okay, 20 minutes, finish the meal, half an hour, got to be out, you're okay. But it's a calculated risk, and as I said to you, I'm not sure the risks are worth it anymore. Our lives are worth nothing to the insurgents. Our lives appear to be worth virtually nothing to the Americans or the British. I think that when you reach a stage where our lives and our jobs are simply no longer respected, you do have to ask the question, is it worth it anymore? I think it is, because I think Iraq is an appalling tragedy. Primarily for Iraqis, of course, who we don't put at the top of our list. We say 1,900 Americans, you know, 93 Brits or whatever it may be. And it's the Iraqis who are doing the suffering and the dying primarily, in vast numbers. Many of them because they trusted us and took our shilling and wanted to work for the police or wanted to work for construction companies building landing strips for the Americans or fortresses for the Americans. But I think the whole Iraqi story for us as journalists is becoming almost impossible to cover. Certainly, if you have a journalist who lives behind two armored walls of a hotel who just uses a mobile phone to call British or American diplomats who are behind another big concrete wall, you might as well live in County Mayo, Ireland, or Santa Fe, New Mexico. There's no point in being there. And, for example, the last trip I made outside Baghdad, it took me 2 weeks to arrange it to go down to Najaf. And it was the most fearful trip. I drove the road with three Iraqi friends, one of them a Shiite prelate, a clergyman, a religious man. All the checkpoints of the Iraqi army had been abandoned. This just after George Bush says the Iraki army is in the field, right? There were upturned Iraqi police cars. burned-out American vehicles. I didn't see a member of the security forces until I reached the outskirts of Najaf, about 80 miles from Iraq. The whole of the countryside outside Baghdad is under the control. It is now the property of the armed insurgents, both Sunni and Shia. This we are not being told. This President Bush will not acknowledge. This our own dear Mr. Blair will not acknowledge. And that is part of the tragedy. And it seems now to be part of our life that New Orleans flooding is not real until it's real, that the collapse of Iraq is not real until it's real. With such poor television coverage, although we did get good pictures, I noticed, of the British soldiers on fire, for heaven's sakes, on their warrior armoured vehicles, I don't know if it's possible to explain what is happening in Iraq anymore. Most journalists, Western journalists, are now relying upon Iraqi stringers, Iraqi correspondents, to risk their necks on the streets. And they are risking their necks, and they are dying for it, to bring in the news. But there are no, by and large, there are no Western eyes, independently, for journalists on the streets, unarmed. My newspaper does not have protection. We do not carry weapons. But my goodness, as I say, I don't know how long we can continue doing this. Each time Patrick and I go to Iraq, it's a little bit worse. And when we look back at what it was like a year ago, which was considered appalling, we're amazed at how free we were, how easily we went grocery shopping. I still go grocery shopping for 6 minutes only, grab the bread, push my way to the front of the queue, pay, out. You learn a lot. I went out to my favorite restaurant, the Ramayya, the other day to find it was no longer the Ramayya. It was now given an Islamic name and had a green neon sign. And when I went inside, the menu was no longer in English, French, and Arabic. It was only in Arabic. No more bottles of Lebanese red wine for Bob of Arabia, of course. It had been totally Islamicized. And you need to get out, see this, and understand it. But the problem is most of our colleagues are not permitted even by their head offices to do that.
You mentioned New Orleans. We've just returned from New Orleans. And something that is most stunning about what has happened with the media, aside from the horror that has taken place, is that because the National Guard were in Iraq, because President Bush did not get the resources there immediately, there were no troops for the reporters to embed with. And so what happened is you had reporters, well, where you often are, with the victims, in the street, reporting the facts on the ground, like we have never seen a reporter with a body that floats by behind them. And then when government officials say this isn't true, the reporters actually challenge the government officials because they are experiencing this themselves. One of the first things President Bush did when he started getting involved was say that the bodies of corpses, the corpses were not to be photographed. I think what has turned this country around right now is that people have truly seen the real images of New Orleans in a way that we have not seen in Iraq. Can you talk about the whole embedding process and the control of the media?
It's not about embedding. It's not about embedding, Amy. It's about television's refusal to show the truth of war. Let me give an example. In 1991... I was driving up the main road towards Basra, the so-called Highway of Death, further up, with a crew from ITV, a British commercial channel. And we stopped at a place where there were large numbers of Iraqi soldiers dead in the desert. And hordes of desert dogs had appeared. And they were ripping the soldiers to pieces and eating them, dragging off an arm here with its hand cruelly going along through the desert, eating through stomachs, gnawing away at cheekbones of dead soldiers. The ITV crew got out and started filming. I said, what are you filming this for? You'll never get it on air. He said, no, it's just for the archives. And this, you see, was the problem. The war was over then. We're talking about the 1991 Gulf War, the liberation of Kuwait, when journalists had been put in pools, which was then the equivalent of embedding. And they chafed that they wanted to report real war and weren't being allowed to. They were being censored. But when the war had ended, and they were allowed to drive up the highway and film anything they wanted, they censored themselves. far too sensitive. Can't see this sort of thing at breakfast. And what about the children? And in London and in Washington and New York and everywhere else, Paris, the television directors and the editors sit and say, oh, we can't show that scene. Impossible. Many of the worst pictures taken in the invasion of Iraq in 2003. A man holding a kid out like a piece of a pancake. A beautiful girl in the arms of a man. We had to lop off here because we didn't want to see the bones of the foot sticking out. She was dead, wounded in many captions. Never saw the light of day. They couldn't be shown. They could, but they were not. Because sensitivities mustn't show this sort of breakfast time. It's irresponsible to show the dead like this. It's disrespectful. I tell you, if you saw what I saw when I go to wars, when I'm on the front line, with or without soldiers, or with civilians, or wounded, or in hospitals, if you saw what I saw, you would never, ever dream of supporting a war again, ever in your life. It's a remarkable thing that the cinema, the commercial cinema, feature films, can now show the bloodiest, goriest scenes, which are quite similar to what we see in real life. Saving Private Ryan, the guts spilling out. And yet, real war cannot be shown without censoring pictures, which in many cases are exactly the same as what you see when you go to the cinema. Or when you watch a movie, a war movie, on television. It's remarkable. And only when you're there do you realize, and I have an editor in London who shakes his head in disbelief and boredom when I say this to him over and over again. If you go to a war, you realize that it is not primarily about victory or defeat. It is about death and the infliction of death and suffering on as large a scale as you can make it. It is about the total failure of the human spirit. But we don't show that because we don't want to. And in this sense, journalists, television reporting, television cameras are lethal. They collude with governments to allow you to have more wars. Because if they showed you the truth, you wouldn't allow any more wars.
Robert Fisk, two questions. One is, why do you think President Bush has done this? And what do you think, since you write in your book that's just about to come out, The Great War for Civilization, about the increasing call of your readers' questions, outcry, what can we do? Why do you think he's done this? What do you think he wants to accomplish now? And what do you think people can do?
Look, what Bush did in 2003 and what our own Lord Blair of Kutalamara, as I call him, did, our Prime Minister, whom we deeply love, what they both did is they made a terrible mistake, which history should have taught them not to make. They went to war for ideological reasons. They dressed it up in military reasons, weapons of mass destruction, saving the poor Shiites or the poor Sunnis or the poor Kurds or whatever you like, destruction of Saddam Hussein, giving democracy to the Middle East. There'll be some more come up soon before we tell the Iraqis that they're ungrateful and they should be more grateful than they are. We're already beginning to tell them in the letters columns, I noticed. But they went to war for ideological reasons. If you do that, you will always fail. You see, everything goes wrong in a war based on ideology, whether it be right-wing Christian ideology, fundamentalist ideology, whether it be the ideology of American Western democracy has to supplant the dictatorships of the Middle East. I won't go into that because we'll all fall asleep. But what happens is that everything about your military purpose gets perverted. For example, look at American intelligence. It's hopeless in Iraq. Absolutely hopeless. All they do is arrest the wrong people. People get beaten up. People get tortured. Yes, they do, by the way. And yet America has this extraordinary intelligence gathering apparatus. Massive supercomputers sucking in telephone calls, millions of them from all over the Middle East. Translators going through page after page, not fast enough, as we know, on September, before September 11th, 2001, but doing it. And they amass this huge volume after volume of intelligence of what's going on in the Middle East. Now, if you're able to understand injustice, which is what the Middle East is partly and principally about, you could make sense of it. But if you're going to go ideologically at this intelligence and try to make it fit what you believe or what you want to believe, then the whole CIA is eliminated. It doesn't matter anymore. It's worthless. And that's why, for example, the background, the foundation of the Iraq war is built on sand, because it was an ideological war. It wasn't based on what do Iraqis want, what would really happen. It was also based on oil. I know that, because if the chief export of Iraq was asparagus, we wouldn't be there, would we? But when you base a war on ideology, that's what happens. You lose. And when you lie about the basis of it, you lose. And the war in Iraq has been lost already. It's only prison journalism or hotel journalism and the lies of the State Department and the Pentagon and the White House and the Downing Street and the Defense Ministry in London and so on that keep this spin rolling. At some point, there's going to be an explosion, the like of which will be inexplicable by those in power. I don't know what it's going to be, but it will come. How do we deal with it? I don't know. You see, those readers who write to me, and still do, literally, I've got a bunch of mail outside the studio in my bag. What can we do? There seems to have been a complete breakdown in Britain between the electors and the elected. One of the reasons, of course, is that the Tory party in Britain supported the Labour Party, and it's the press who've become the opposition. You have a bigger problem in the United States in that, as I understand it, well, I'll quote actually a US Marine who said to me in San Diego a few months ago, our problem is we have this kind of false democracy. He said, we go and vote for our senators or congressmen for what they say they'll give us, and then they go and say something completely different. And I think you have a big problem with lobby groups. I don't just mean the Israeli lobby, I mean the gun lobby and so on. I think you have a major problem with lobby groups in Washington. And every president comes along saying he's going to clean that out, but he never does. Actually, Bush didn't say that, not George W. anyway. But I think you have a much bigger problem in the United States where on issues like the Middle East, for example, your voice is simply not heard unless it is pro-Israeli, pro-American policy in the Middle East, etc., up on the Hill. I mean, you'll get a few brave souls, Paul Finley, and look what happened to him. But basically, you won't get represented on these critical issues. And American policy in the Middle East is the critical issue in all our lives at the moment. I might go at much greater length into this in my new book, at the issue of why after September 11th, 2001. I remember having this terrible argument with that Boston professor, Dershowitz, who called me a dangerous man. He's anti-American, it's the same as being anti-Semitic, which is rubbish, of course. I'm neither. But anyone who asked the question, why did it happen, was seen as being unpatriotic, potential enemy, therefore anti-American, anti-people, anti-democracy. Because, of course, to ask the question why, we have to say, well, hold on a second, the 19 hijackers came from the Arabs, they came from the Middle East. Is there a problem out there? And we can't go into that. And it's strange because, you know, if you have a crime in Santa Fe, the cops come along and the first thing they do is look for the motive. But when you have an international crime against humanity on the scale of September 11th, 2001, the one thing you're not allowed to do is look for the motive for the crime. And I think that, by and large, for many months, Americans were prevented from looking for the motive. And by the time they could look for the motive, oh, we were bombing Afghanistan and saying there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and then defeating Saddam Hussein, and so it goes on and on. And it seems somehow that modern-day politicians, with, in many cases, the help, I'm afraid, of journalists, are able to continue to bamboozle people. We'll explain it tomorrow. Oh, that's too secret to tell you. Senior intelligence officials insist. Look at the New York Times' first paragraphs over and over again. According to American intelligence officials, American officials say. I think sometimes the New York Times should be called American officials say. Just look at it tomorrow or the day after. Or the LA Times or the San Francisco, no, not the San Francisco Chronicle. It's not much of a paper anymore, unfortunately, but the Washington Post. It's almost as if, you know, the cozy relationship between American journalists and power is very dangerous. You want to look and see what that relationship is like, the osmotic, you know, the host and the parasite together. You only have to look at a White House press conference. Mr. President, Yes, Bob. Yes, John. Yes, Nancy. That's the relationship. And journalists like to be close to power. And they know that if they want to be close to power, they mustn't challenge power. And that goes back to the Amira Haas definition of journalism, which I am a total devotee of. You must challenge power all the time, all the time, all the time, even if the politicians and the prime minister, even if your readers hate you, you must challenge power. And that includes bin Laden power.
Robert Fisk, we are out of time, but I just have a quick question, perhaps the biggest
to
ask.
Thank goodness, Amy.
And that is, you've covered the Israeli invasions of Lebanon, the Iranian Revolution, the Iran-Iraq War, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Gulf War, wars in Algeria, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Enough, enough, enough.
What gives you hope? What gives you hope?
Nothing. I'm sorry, nothing. I'm sorry. Nothing at the moment. Ordinary people, I guess. Ordinary people who speak out. People in the Arab world as well. But in terms of governments, nothing much. I may be wrong. I may be too much of a pessimist because I've seen too much.
Well, and especially in light of that last answer, I think your courage, your bravery, your conviction just continues to astound all of us. Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. I also want to thank William Moulton and Rob Althaus, who filmed tonight. Again, the Lensic and the Lannan Foundation. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.